This is the Outrider Podcast. They say.
All right.
I like the art gallery there behind you.
Yeah, I've been meaning to do this in the house for most of the summer. Finally did it last week. Got some painter's tape, and I'll take you on a tour sometime. There's a couple sets of walls designated to the amazing amount of art that the kids churn out.
Right.
That was fun to look at, because if I keep it all, we have these big portfolios for them that their grandparents gave them.
Right.
It's easy just to forget them all kind of stacked away. So
right.
It's kind of fun. Plus, we're really bad about hanging stuff up, and this is really easy. And they're fun to look at.
Yeah. I don't have anything hanging on my walls, but, you know, random stuff that... you know, I collect it as I write, but who knows? So, okay, here was the idea. For the first one, we talked about resistance, you know, the writer and artist resisting political climate and all this other stuff. Then we talked about, you know, meditation and making that private space to be creative, to be separate from and outside the mass culture that's so intent on distracting us and, you know, keeping us from working. What I kind of... ended up started to think about, but couldn't ever really manage my thoughts, so I might stumble a bit here, was this idea of community, because we talked about this as we've been struggling to get this third one lined up, is, you know, we're kind of in these vacant areas for our particular creative interests. I don't know what the music scene is like down there where you live. What is the music scene like down there? Is there one?
Well, it's pretty good. I mean, not too long ago, I was playing the same venues as the Alabama Shakes and St. Paul and the Broken Bones. And mm-hmm. I mean, just to mention two that have gone on at a more national level. There's a lot of stuff here, especially with UA, University of Alabama, uh-huh. the new school there, and the composers coming in and coming out of there. I can't, there, in terms of music, there's probably more happening than I can get to and get to see. I mean, there's a lot of good music here, made here and coming through here. So I don't have complaints about that. I guess there are communities set up for all of that. I can say around here, it seems like there is at the library, there are poetry readings pretty frequently, and there are slam events here and there,
right.
Which just, that's not my thing. I don't do that.
You know? Right.
And I think there's a flourishing element of that here. And I think here it's either in schools or you have to have a book of some sort out before anyone is going to contact you for anything. At least I think so. I don't know. Right. I keep myself pretty busy, so I don't know if I remove myself from those things anyway.
Right. Yeah, that's something I occasionally wonder about when it comes to community around here, because, you know, here we have the Wichita State University MFA program, which is one of the older MFA programs in the country, but they're not very social outside of the department. They don't have an outreach program. They don't really engage with local writers. They just stick with the students that come in. And, you know, they have a reading series that they do in conjunction with Watermark Books, the independent bookstore here, but you don't really see them out much. You don't see them engaging with the rest of the literary community. And, you know, we have a lively music scene. We have a lively visual arts scene and an active theater community here. But when it comes to literature, everything seems to be fragmented into these little cliquish groups. There are the self-published, you know, which just an entertaining way to make a buck. And all they want to do is get together and talk about their marketing strategy and how they get, you know, their little following of 10,000 people so that they reach that, you know, steady state plateau of income, you know, or there's the people like me that are kind of, you know, we've done something, you know, we've had a book published and, you know, we're in that, how do you get the next one published? How do you keep yourself interested in what you're doing from a creative and artistic point? Because I actually do think of what we do as an art and not a craft or a performance or an income generation stream. I'm not about creating content. I'm trying to do something, right?
Yeah, that's... I would say, I mean, but isn't this, I think if I looked at the music thing, so the music situation is probably as fragmented, mm-hmm. but I think overall you're going to get more participation because it just is probably more fun than a lit reading.
Right.
Or like doing a workshop with a group of folks.
Right.
So I don't know if it's always just a thing and writers are, I think part of it is, you know, it takes a lot of time.
Right.
Even if you're going to do like a self-published kind of marketing mm-hmm. book, it takes some time to put together, you know, your clever title and topic and how many numbers you want to include in the
right
title and that kind of thing. And, you know, what's your platform? Is it going to launch from your website or your blog or, yeah, I mean, so even that has a certain amount. Talking about it as art then as well, it takes time.
Yeah.
Writers tend to be curmudgeonly.
Oh yeah. That's kind of why I like to meet them and be around them. I get a kick out of other people's curmudgeonliness, but you know, I have a hard time getting writers to come out on, you know, one night a month to just hang out. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, yes, not everybody's going to want to go to, you know, readings all the time at bookstores and stuff like that. I'm not talking about that kind of community. I mean, writing is not performative. It's not like music. It's not something you can put on display like art, you know, and wander past with a glass of wine while you're talking about the dogs at home, you know. It's
Well, that's what they do for the library program here that's called Bards and Brews, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, so you have, I think they showcase some of the local breweries and stuff. Mm-hmm. And along with that, then people sign up. There may be, I'm assuming there's someone who's, you know, an MC of some sorts. And I think people sign up and read. And it's not that it's excluded. It's not excluded to
right.
slam poetry. But from what I understand, that's often, it's that or it's, you know, folks that just are going and want to have fun. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's not really, as far as I know, even local poets from around here who've been published, I don't think anyone goes up there and reads. You know, it's more of a fun atmosphere. So when you get up there and read your poem about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico or whatever, then, you know, it's just going to...
right.
It feels like it's not the right thing. Yeah, I don't know. I'm also separated from a lot of it because I don't have an MFA, and I don't always know what those channels are. Like, mm-hmm. you know, where are people talking? Where they're going? Those kind of things. So
right. Yeah, I don't know. No, I'm not too, you know, I'm not trying to be, well, let me back up a little bit. We do have a regular reading, poetry reading called Syntactics that goes on once a month here that's run by this young guy named Ryan Harrell and his friend DC Warren. And neither one of them, you know, are going the MFA route with their stuff. And it's great to go out there and see a bunch of young people reading and interested in writing and books. And I've become kind of a regular and get, you know, joked at as being, you know, the elder statesman and all this other stuff. And I don't really read that often because what I get from the event, the tenor of the whole thing, is that a lot of these guys will, they're shooting for the laugh in whatever they've written, you know, and there are a few, there are a few guys that come up, you know, that will read some very serious stuff, you know, and that feels like an outlier type of situation because DC and Ryan and, you know, about three or four other guys that are regular readers. And that's the other thing that's noticed, almost always guys. And women show up, but it's like the girlfriends and girls that like these guys that show up and they just stay silent, which is kind of disturbing. But anyway, so they get up.
I've been that young guy irritating other writers when I was I was really into performance art,
right?
And I was also writing, but the stuff that I would do on stage, like miking tape recorders, laying on the floor, reading Do Not Go Gentle Into That Goodnight with a helium balloon. I co-ran the readings at the Chucker, and the Chucker was this, it was the oldest bar, I think, at that time in Alabama. It was a cool little grungy place. I mean, paintings of bikers on the walls.
Right.
It was, the bar had been cut in half at one point by a chainsaw to make room for a pool table that was like jammed up against the front door.
Right.
It was that kind of place. So whenever we did the readings, you know, I was that irritating person for many of the MFAs there. I feel like I know I can I'm judging by the looks and things that, and so I took it as that vehicle for, that I read Unskinny Bop by Poison as a Miri Baraka, basically. I rarely read my original poems. I always did, or if I did, I always did something performance based on them because it was on a stage and it was that kind of thing. And so sorry. I've been that person who would have irritated you at the reading.
Well, I'm not irritated by these guys. I think I'm trying to be supportive because they are doing a regular open mic reading, and Ryan and DC are, even though they have their thing, I think Ryan wanted at one point to be a stand-up comedian but has drifted into writing, which is fine. So he's going for humor to begin with. That seems to be what he's interested in writing. And that's fine. And he's got a good handle on story structure and timing and comedy. So his stories are entertaining as well as DC's. But you know, the thing that, and I'm supporting these guys and attending regularly because part of the reason these open mic readings die, the reason that we can't seem to sustain anything, is because people that are, you know, somewhat established never show up, never participate. And he's got the drive to keep this thing going. And I think it's important that those of us who can get out there and show a little support for these kids that haven't been published, that are making an attempt to do the work, whatever that work looks like, because, you know, it's probably not fair for me to constantly compare my situation or my desires with my vision or perhaps my delusions about history. right? You know, the Greatest Generation, the Beats, you know, you read the biographies and the histories, and so much of that, I think, has become a kind of mythology.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Well, we talked about, I don't know when we talked about that, but we talked about that a little with talking about the Skrull version of On the Road and the various versions of that. And
right.
First Thought, Best Thought, and some of those other ideas that were just ideas that become,
right,
mythologized.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm trying to modulate my expectations based upon this pseudo mythology of the two literary eras that I know the most about, compared with what I pick up from writer friends who are in New York and San Francisco, where there seems to be, you know, some type of regular literary goings on that people are going to. People seem to know each other and interact with each other in those places in a way that I don't seem to be interacting with other writers around here. You know, I follow writers I've talked to for the podcast in its previous iteration, you know, like Laird Hunt and Colin Dickey and people like that that are, Laird's in Denver, but travels a lot, and Colin's in New York. And they seem to know agents and editors from multiple houses and places that they've met and encountered at, you know, at things like, what is it? KGB is the bar that hosts a lot of literary readings, and other bars and stuff around New York and Manhattan and Brooklyn in particular, and everything. And those kind of connections, that kind of stuff isn't happening out here for me. I can't really travel like that. And interacting online is not really something I'm terribly good at. And plus it means I have to spend even more time in front of a computer.
And it's not the same thing. I don't think. But is it ever going to be? I mean, those places are where the industry and a lot of the people who work in it, that's where they are, right?
Yeah. I mean, but how can I live there? That's the thing that constantly perplexes me is with student loan debt and all that other stuff. Am I now, because of our economic situation and my geographical situation, am I then just, and me and people like me, just not supposed to write anymore? Are we only supposed to get literature from the coasts and people that are connected to each other? And
I don't think so. It's just more, well, it's a different kind of difficult, I guess. Yeah. In a flyover state.
Right. Right.
I mean, unless you're hooked up at a college, because, you know, there are a lot of writers who are teaching in colleges all around as well.
Right, right.
And departments and things like that, where they're also connected through that.
Mm-hmm. There was an article I've stumbled across a while ago. It's on a blog and a website by this guy, Jeff Goins or Goins. I'm not sure.
Goins, yeah, I think.
Yeah, he writes a lot about writing, but he only seems to write books about writing and nothing else. And one book is billed as a New York Times bestseller, but I'm pretty sure that he got that marker much the same way that most business books get the New York Times bestseller marker, which is the writer buys the requisite number of books to get on the bestseller list from his publisher and then gives them away at speaking engagements or events, or, you know, donates them to businesses or whatever later on, so that he can then slap New York Times bestseller on additional versions of the book or the next book or whatever. And it's not actually because individual people thought, oh, this is a great book. But he did have an interesting article on his blog post. Interesting in that it made me think. This is why I brought up, wanted to talk about this, you know, thing of community. This post of his called "The Rule of the Scene: Why Where You Live Affects the Work You Do." I, you know, like I said, it's been a couple of weeks since I read it, and it's a bit problematic, and it kind of has some of the same flaws that I have in my own little, you know, delusions about historical literary scenes. But when I think about what I was doing when I was in Boulder and in graduate school and around a bunch of writers there, compared to what I'm doing now and how motivated and inspired I feel now compared to then. And yeah, seeing kind of where you are and who you're among kind of really does have an impact on what you write, how creative you are. Do you think that's true? Am I right to think that?
It might depend on the person. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's obviously something to it with the beats, you know, thinking of the moderns. And even whenever you get into it and look at all the little squabbles, you know, Ezra right. Pound had with everybody, or, you know, the little backbiting stuff, Hemingway, Faulkner, although I wouldn't say they were part of a scene. I mean, maybe they were. I mean, they probably were dealing with similar editors, similar parties. Supposedly Hemingway broke Wallace Stevens's jaw at a party in Florida. I mean, there's...
Thought it was his nose.
His nose? I heard it was his jaw. I don't know.
See, the maybe. Mythology thing. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. Hemingway's one for mythologizing as well.
Exactly.
But, and there's obviously something to it. I don't know. I haven't... It seems like... Mm-hmm. My attachment to anything like that has been usually very brief and mostly online, where I have like a group of writers who are kind of inspiring each other and pushing each other forward and that kind of thing. But I've rarely, unless I'm collaborating with someone, I've never had that in person.
Yeah, that's the thing that kind of disturbs me. I mean, I'm still writing, I'm still creating, but I'm not... I go back and I read stuff that I wrote in graduate school. I read sections from The Evolution of Shadows. And then I go through stuff I've been writing since. And sometimes it seems to be along those lines, that creative, that it has a different rhythm and tone that I'm more pleased with than some of the other stuff that I write, which seems to be more reminiscent of the awful stuff I wrote before graduate school. You know, really self-obsessed, internal-looking, biographical, linear, you know, the short declarative Hemingway sentence and the Raymond Carver thing, as opposed to more, I don't know, lyrical. And, you know, I worry that, because what I see among writers here that I have managed to be friends with and occasionally read their stuff and talk to them about writing, I don't know if it's a like I said, that's why kind of why I worry about the location and the scene. They're doing interesting work. They're writing well. They're not being hacky and cliched. They're not, you know, using tropes in an unexamined way and creating formulas. They're doing original work. And, you know, I don't want to, this is where I start worrying about other psychological problems, like a need to sabotage myself. And if I have these opinions or these ideas, and I want to be encouraging to these people and friendly and nice, but it's like, you know, if I found your book in the bookstore, I wouldn't pick it up and read it. And they wouldn't read mine probably either. And that's not a reflection on their talent or their skill or their readability or anything. Just, it's not my thing. And it's not like in graduate school there were people that were good and they didn't really write stuff that I, you know, I could help them get better at what they were doing. I would be very professional in my critiques of their stories and things like that. And then there were people like my friend Laura or Gavin who did stuff and I was like, dude, give me that story. How do you do this? What's going on here? And I don't find anybody like that around here. And that's kind of disturbing to me. In my local scene, there's nobody here who's doing something that I'm like, how did you do that? You know,
I've connected. I don't know how much it's helped my own work. I really don't. And not saying that they would read it, but for me, part of that connection has been, it takes a lot of time and all that, but doing the poet interviews for Eunoia Solstice, I have three I'm kind of working on now. One is just about finished. And so far I've interviewed, everyone has been an Alabama poet. Mm-hmm. And at the time, all four of them are teachers of some sort.
Right.
They all have multiple books of poetry out. And for me, what that's allowed me to do and this isn't the same thing because it is really opening up and reading someone's work multiple times and really digging in it and, you know, looking, I don't want to say not as positive, but just it allows, I guess the way I'd say is it allows me to be a generous reader.
Right.
And with that, I've had that kind of experience, but I can't say I've had that. That's kind of a one directional kind of experience with it. Like I haven't had that experience with my own work where someone's kind of digging in and, you know, asking me about certain things. So,
right.
And it's not a, I'm trying to think of how, like, how often it is outside of a classroom that I ever talk to anyone in person about poetry. I mean, it just rarely happens for me anyway. It just rarely happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that is my problem. I'm not being fair to people and their interests. You know, if they don't want to talk about writing, then I'm like, okay, we'll talk about this, but okay.
Yeah, and most of those conversations have been either through email for me or this, you know. I don't, otherwise, it just rarely. You know, I work at a regular high school, so it's not like a fine arts high school,
right?
And it's not a college with an English department or like a creative writing department. Mm-hmm. I was a co-sponsor of the Creative Writing Club last year. That teacher has gone to a different job, so I'll probably be sponsoring it. And our first meeting, there were maybe, I don't remember, maybe 15 people there. And then as we got into the writing, it went like from, say, 15 to 20.
Right.
To maybe 5. To 2. To no one showing up for the meetings.
Right.
And, you know, at that point, it was just like, I can't help you with anything. And part of what the way I've talked about it with them is it's so easy to find places to submit to now, through various avenues. And there's several that just specialize in, there's kind of an advantage there for them because there are many that specialize in the writing of young people, high school and lower. I sometimes there's, you know, in a given year, there's little to no interest in it at all. So
kind of related to this, I had a conversation with a friend last week because I've recently started using this online therapy service called betterhelp.com in an attempt to, address some, personal issues around, relationships and writing and creativity and my sense of malaise and frustration and boredom and, self-sabotage and everything. And the friend asked me, well, why are you even doing this therapy? You don't like the therapist. You criticize them for not being as well-read in literature and things like that as you are. And so why are you really doing this? And my first response was, well, I can't do this to my friends. Right?
Didn't something similar happen at a reading or writing circle you were a part of?
Yeah, it seems to happen to me a lot, which is probably why I'm always very... It's probably why when I go out drinking with friends the next morning, I wake up going, man, you just need to shut your mouth. Just stop talking. And it seems like I have developed this habit around here of either not saying anything to anybody or insulting them for not basically being me. and not being interested in talking about books all the time and writing and things like that. And I can't keep doing that. I can't keep alienating the people around me who are nice people. They're smart. They're sensitive. They're empathetic. You know, they've got lives. They're doing interesting things. And somehow I manage to, take these people and make them feel like shit every time they're around me. Right. So I guess that's probably part of why I'm doing the therapy thing as well. But there's something missing and I can't quite figure out what it is right now. And I'm worried that it's affecting the writing. And that's kind of why that article by that Goins guy was Goins or whatever his last name is, why I was both skeptical of it and going and then wanting to throw it at people going, you know, this is what's wrong. And probably what's wrong is, you know, just that.
That you threw it at them?
That I threw it at them. Yeah. you know, and you know, the truth is and I think this is probably what happens when, you know, when people, one, are isolated or feel isolated, you get to a certain mm-hmm. age and, you know, especially for men, you're isolated. You kind of lost the ability to really make new friendships or new connections.
It's difficult. And it gets difficult as you get older. Yeah, I agree.
And there's this thing that I do that really kind of, for me, you know, grounds my perception and my understanding of who I am as a person. And it feels as if that thing, it's almost like it's, when I bring it up or it comes out, the response, at least the way I perceive it, and I could be entirely wrong, is everybody else just kind of like around me patting my head going, oh, Jason, you know, you've got your chew toy, go in the corner. Yeah, who's the person that's as passionate about this kind of thing as I am?
Well, I mean, some of them, as he said, have probably, you know, packed up everything and gone to one of the coasts. Right. You know, I don't know. Or they're in, you know, creative writing departments and things like that.
Yeah.
Because most of the folks, particularly if they're interested in writing as an art form in some mm-hmm. way, are likely have to make some sort of other income through right. something else.
Yeah, absolutely.
A friend of mine, I did an interview, man, this is a long time ago. I think this was, well, maybe that isn't that long ago. Maybe 5 years. Mm-hmm. 5 years or so ago, something like that. And on the set of interviews, I don't think they're available anymore. But on the set of interviews, Jeff Goins was one of the other people who was interviewed. And I think I was interviewed because this was after I had won that Washington Post, the haiku contest uh-huh. for the centennial of the National Cherry Blossom Festival.
Right.
And it led to these weird interviews. And this was one where I was kind of talking about family and writing, trying to balance all that stuff. And
right.
Jeff Goins was the other person who was interviewed. And so I started looking at his stuff. And this was when he had a newsletter and a blog. And it was at the point where he quit his day job and started the writing. But what was weird for me and confusing at first is I couldn't quite wrap my head around, like, how is this about writing? Because the whole thing was about that stuff. And so one of the tricks that I learned from it, and one that, hey, who knows, maybe I'll benefit by it one day, was, and it's exactly some of the kind of stuff that you mentioned with the, so if you do a self-published book mm-hmm. or and publish something through Amazon or whatever,
right?
One of the ways to shoot your book up a chart is that you, through your newsletter or your blog or whatever, mm-hmm. you do a sale that day and you say, hey, the new book is, you know, you make it $1, you make it $2, you make it free. Right. It's free for 48 hours or it's free this week and then it goes back up to its price. You make it free. And I learned this was all the stuff that he was talking about. I was like, what is this about writing? And so you make it free and it shoots up a chart and then you can say, oh, I had an Amazon bestseller.
Right.
And then you keep, you know, you do that over and over again and do some of the other things. So yeah, your sense of that and what that stuff is right. It's marketing and it's this and that. And yeah, I mean, that stuff's important, but it goes, and you know, it's part of the reason why I mean, the stuff that I write and most of the stuff that I'm interested in, is just not going, it's just not going to be that popular. It's not going to be.
Yeah. Because we're not creating content that then can be pushed like, you know, widgets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's kind of the thing that, I almost said you can't do that, but yet everybody out there is proving me wrong that you can, in fact, do that, right?
There's a market for all that stuff because people want
content that.
Well, you can do that. You can find all kinds of weird side jobs where you're typing up stuff for hours or rephrasing. Right. Something to get put on something. But I mean, like, it's like all the conferences and all of the, I see it for me as it's like an extension of the life coaching kind of stuff. Is that self, but my metaphor for it's always been the, you know, the comic at the, or like in comic books where they had the ad, you know, it says, do you want to learn how to make $100?
Right.
Send $1 in, you know, to us and find out how. And it's that kind of thing. It's not really about, and then it just, you know, they send, and that's the way that.
Yeah, it's not
like about. Like, you have to become that thing in order to profit from it and make money from it, because that's where they're making their money. It's based on people's desires and their wishes. And, you know, they want to be J.K. Rowling, or they want to be Stephen King, or they want to be something like that. And it really isn't about writing or about art or even about, you know, you separated art and craft. I sometimes can see that they're often kind of squeezed together in my mind. But
art and craft, they work together, but they can also be separated. It's the difference between a portrait painter and a house painter, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. They both, you know, you have to understand how paint applies to a surface in both cases. You have to understand how to mix paint, how, you know, and what type of paint to use and yada, whatever. But one you're using for a purely functional purpose, paint a house. The other one you're using for, some kind of expression. And, you know, but they still have to know about their brushes and, you know, how to, so you don't leave a streak behind that looks weird, you know, when you're, you know, that type of stuff. That's the craft side of it, how to use your tools to do what you're going to do. And the art side is then how that craft gets applied. You know, that's what's funny. I mean, I started recently doing this meetup group on meetup.com. Trying to get writers, at least are using this app, to come out and just meet and get to know, see who else is out doing writing in this town. And maybe you meet someone who's a kindred spirit and you can go off and form your own little community. But here's this thing. And I've come across, there was a gentleman that I met there this time who, you know, I asked him what he read, what he liked to read. And it was all just, you know, nonfiction stuff. But he was making a big deal about how he had started writing novels and he really liked it. And it's like, okay. And you had self-published all of them. And it's like, and it was this moment where I almost wanted to go, so you're a novelist who doesn't read novels. How does that work? You know, it's like the poet who doesn't read poetry. You know, that's like the worst poetry on the planet. Is poetry by someone who does not read poetry?
Yeah.
You know, it's,
I guess the thing too, I mean, if that guy's happy doing that and that's all he wants to do, awesome.
Yeah. Have a hobby. Do whatever you need to do.
And it's likely he'll make more money than I will ever than off of any kind of poems I write. But at the same time, hopefully the person who just finds the joy in that, writing whatever, and is, you know, just cranking out, you know, the self-published novels and enjoys it.
Right.
Hopefully they understand why other, you know, critics and other, like, people aren't going to have the same joy that they have.
Right.
And they're, you know, it's like if I built model trains and I love model trains and, you know, I'm talking to you about my model trains and, you know, how I put, I don't know enough about model trains to even make right. this metaphor work, but, you know what I mean? Like, I can't expect someone else to have that same, and that goes for a lot of stuff, but.
Well, you can't be into model trains and then expect an actual conductor to take you seriously. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's kind of the thing. And that's kind of what I think, you know, I've always tried to figure out what is it that annoys me about the most about self-published writers. And, you know, there are self-published writers who take their, what they're doing very, very seriously. They know why they're self-publishing. They know the industry and they're doing this for a reason, mm-hmm. you know, and it's has to do with, you know, the mid-list disappearing from the publishing landscape. And,
mm-hmm. and yeah, if they have a name, sometimes it's great for them because, yeah, you know, I guess the guy that comes to mind that I know of who does this a lot is Chuck Wendig. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he's done well with those Star Wars novels and stuff. I mean, anything with Star Wars on it, you're kind of printing right. some money. I mean, as a household name, he's, you know, how many writers are, I mean, he's not there, but he does, you know, he's a practicing writer. I mean, he's one of those guys that gets, I don't know, more than one book done a year, which right. is insane, but he does, you know, a whole crop of kind of different books on craft and stuff like that, but he knows what he's talking about. It's right. in that, I believe a lot of that stuff allows him to supplement income, and more power to him, you know, right. I mean, there's a way for that to make sense, but a lot of them, a lot of the craft books and stuff are kind of, it's like, well, where are your books? Why would
I want to, yeah.
you know?
Yeah. That's why when I, you know, realized that this Goins guy didn't have anything other than his books on how to be creative, that he was doing that thing where you're not talking about the thing, you're simply using the illusion to make money off the illusion and not actually doing the thing. You know, that's, I think what annoys me a lot about self-published writers that are doing it just as the hobby is that they will sometimes walk into situations and expect to be taken as seriously as the writer who spent, you know, 3 years working on a novel and another 3 years trying to find an agent and a publisher. And, you know,
well, unfortunately, sometimes they are taking that seriously. And sometimes it's, I mean, there are folks who, you know, start up their own imprint and then are able to milk it. And, you know, in Alabama, that's a small place, you know, I've seen it, you know, and those people can wield power and it it makes for some ugly, you know, some ugly situations, I think. You know?
Yeah. And I think, like I said before, I think a lot of that arises because you have that disappearing mid-list. So you'd have, you know, those writers that used to get decent publishing contracts and be able to write one or two books a year, you know, hit 10 to 15,000 readers out there in the world, you know, or less, but consistently make money for the mm-hmm. publisher, which allowed the publisher to go on and do other things, to buy that big, you know, book that will, you know, make millions of dollars. And with that disappearing, and with basically the whole middle section of the, and with, you know, the literary establishment then breaking into the New York camp and the MFA camp, and there are no longer any, you know, blue-collar working-class writers really getting picked up and thrown into the mid-list and having decent, stable careers. It's either the giant bestseller, the self-published person, and everybody else is scrambling.
Well, celebrities, as you see all the books coming out by celebrities.
Right.
You'll see the novelizations, mm-hmm. you know, of what's the, yeah, they're now all these, not only probably comic book versions of, say, the new Wonder Woman movie, but now they're coming out with, you know, they're having, you know, kind of popular sci-fi fantasy folks write these novelizations of right. those movies. And I don't know. I guess it's selling.
And that's why I think it's so, that's why this question of community is so on the front of my brain right now, with this bifurcation, this dual bifurcation, a quadrification. You know, you've got New York, MFA, traditionally published, self-published. And then there's that in-between group, people like me who don't want to have to spend a shit ton of time worrying about, you know, marketing and publicity. There's whole group of people that like doing that have made that their job, marketing and publicizing books. And I can help them when my book comes out and do things and come up with some ideas, but I would like the bulk of that work to be done by them so that I can go back to writing, which is what I do best, which if I do well enough can help support them and me and right. And that's kind of the environment I would like to be in. But that seems kind of difficult with this splitting up into these four camps. And so it troubles me on two fronts. One, my own inability, it seems, to be a decent and sympathetic human being to the writers around me. My inability to curb my attitude at times, which I understand is a weakness. I'm self-aware enough to do that. But also the inability of other people to realize that despite their aspirations, if we don't come to find a way to work together in our little community to support that kind of literary ecosystem here, there won't be anybody out there to read the shit we write. There won't be anybody to support us. And the thing will just further slip away into academic university settings or into these little tiny pockets where the cities are big enough to support, you know, the thin, you know, communities that just feed themselves, you know. Poets who read to poets and nobody else. Fiction writers that write their books just for other fiction writers and nobody else. I mean, that's kind of where I'm at, you know, and I don't know how to fix it except just to talk about it. And the only person who doesn't kind of roll their eyes and start talking about other things around me is you. And that's because we really only do these conversations, you know, once a month or once every other month. And, you know, my friends that I go out to drinks with on Monday nights, you know, they're kind of sick of me, I think, and frustrated by it. And then there are the people I meet at the meetup group that, you know, there's maybe a handful that are starting to become regulars, but we've had so many people that show up once and I happen to be having a bad day. And I try to be, you know, a benevolent crank, but I still end up being a crank, and that's terrible.
I mean, I have friends who do art and, you know, work with film and stuff like that. And those mediums are just more sexier and interesting to people. And there's also, like, my friends who draw or do artwork like that, it's weird how the community around them, like, just taking comics, there's all these little subdivisions in comics. There's people doing art, you know, these weird art comics. And in comics, self-publishing is awesome. People love it. I mean, there's no funk to it. I mean, right now, Ed Piskor, who I probably said his name wrong, he's a friend of a friend, but he designed so a couple of things he's done recently is, you know, what is it called? His main title that he's been doing for quite a while. It's terrible. Anyway, he's just now doing this. It's like a mix of, they announced this at Comic-Con, this mix of the first 250 issues of X-Men he has put into a single storyline that he's writing and is now writing and drawing himself. Uh-huh. And I think last year he designed these Public Enemy action figures. And he started...
Right, so he does the Hip-Hop Family Tree.
Hip-Hop Family Tree, that's it, yeah. Okay. He's fantastic, and he just keeps getting better and better and better. My friend introduced me to him several years back, and the guy is awesome and super cool guy. But just like in terms of what you're talking about, that art and craft stuff, like the guy just, and the thing is he was, whenever I first kind of started looking at his work, it was really good. And he just, the thing is, he just keeps getting better and better. There's another guy who's kind of, they kind of bleed across these different kind of popular and less popular comic forms, or less, I guess, in the ones that are not as seen as frequently in comic stores or whatever.
Right.
And all that's because of the way that the catalogs are done. But his name's Jim Rugg. And Jim Rugg is incredible and just keeps getting better and better and better. But those guys, you know, part of the thing is they can do illustrations. They can do illustration work. They can get paid for doing it.
Right.
Sometimes they work on, there's one comics guy that I know who did like background illustrations and stuff on Adventure Time and things like that. Like literally would draw like cups and things in the background and had, you know, an income, part of his income from that. And then he kind of stratified all the different, you know, he would do art, he would do art comics, and then he would do more mainstream comics, illustrations for band posters and that kind of thing. So there's kind of range of outlets, self-publishing some of his work, and then some of his other work gets picked up by other people. Mm-hmm. And like Ed there, you know, he's doing this X-Men run for Marvel, and he starts doing all this self-publishing. What I watch with them, you know, it's you do see that community, and you also see option, you know, outlets for them where people are excited about the work they're doing. And like, you know, they can post a drawing on Twitter and it's like this instant, like, wow, I mean, my family doesn't even read a poem. You know, when I get a poem published or whatever, I mean, if I asked them about it, they wouldn't, you know, I doubt if my wife even reads them, to be honest. you know, and it's, and I don't know what to, I mean, I've just resigned myself. You know, I finally finished this, a full-length manuscript of poems, and I've been working towards that for a long time. And especially those last 2 months, it was, you know, it was a couple, well, if I mean, it didn't, I can't say I worked on that manuscript in terms of, you know, in terms of where the poem started in there, it's 12 years, if I count, like, when some of the first poems in this group were first written.
Right.
And I worked and worked at organizing this manuscript, finally finished it in June. And now I don't know what to do. I mean, what you do with poetry is you enter contests and stuff. And, you know, I've had a couple of people read it and they liked it, but there wasn't, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, so I have, you know, this full length manuscript, and I guess what I can do, and the thing that sucks about it is with poetry is like I've got to, you know, send out $15 or $20, you know, contest entries, you know, to see what happens to try to get it. I mean, that's just the process for it. If you're not connected to a publisher, and I'm not, this would be my first, you know, full length release. Mm-hmm. And so there's that, and the organizing of that, which is all one thing. And then the other is I really enjoyed that long form process, and I want to do it again, but it's now I'm kind of in that anxiety of between, you know, for one, the other one isn't even out. I'm not even sure what to do with it except for in the contest as it is. And, you know, and there's whole sections of it that are what some people would say experimental. Mm-hmm. So, you know, am I just burn it? Should I just stack up the money for the entries and just burn it? You know, is that going to be a better use of the money than, you know, I don't know yet.
And
I may try to just send out some of the more of the original poems, the experimental ones, and see if I can get some of those published. And then, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. And that's kind of the problem. I mean, I think that kind of highlights the problem with the lack of community in your area and mine when it comes to poets, because it is such an insulated thing, such an out of the mainstream type of situation, is that if you're not in a university setting as a poet, then it's a real challenge to get anything seen anywhere without, you know, constantly having to pay, you know, contest fees.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think maybe the ridiculous, weird, stupid answer is to, you know, make sure that when you send out individual poems for journals or whatever, that you make sure it's always a journal that'll pay you. And then you take that payment and turn it right. Don't put it in your bank account. Just turn it right back around into a contest fee, you know?
Yeah, that is almost non-existent for poets.
Right.
I mean, there's no way Paul Muldoon is going to pick me for the New Yorker. And from what I understand there, the New Yorker, he refuses to read anything by anyone he doesn't know.
Yeah. Are you on...
go ahead.
Are you on Submittable? Do you have a Submittable? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you've got... they're taking that submishmash and they're now incorporating it into the Submittable app to show you opportunities.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but most of them, I mean, if you look at them...
Even for individual poems, they charge a reading fee?
Not everyone does, but I mean, if it's a contest, they do.
Right.
In terms of getting something published, I mean, if you're not hit up with a submission fee, you know, some of them that do, that may pay, there's not many, at least that I've been able to find.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to look harder, but also then the work that I may be sending out, you know, it doesn't always seem to, you know, fit with the journal, because I try to sit down and actually read the journals before I spend the time in making the submission and all that. That's why that's where I found Shuf Poetry, which is where I was able to, I mean, they were the most rejected poems I've ever written. I can't count how many times these things were rejected, and they're odd. One is based, it's a calculus equation with a truth table is how it's set up as a poem. And the other one is a Zen circle or a clock or an egg and, you know, sperm around it, depending on how you look at it and read it. And they're these kind of graphic letter poems that I've been working on and off, based on a single letter. And, you know, that's how I found Shuf Poetry, and, you know, they were published there. So it was nice. But some of the other ones, I don't know. I don't know if it means I need to go back and do another draft. I don't know. Or start sending it out. I'm just at that point. I don't really know what to do with it, you know.
Right. We should set you up with a donation page. get people to donate money to your submission fees.
Well, my plan is, if I can ever get anything out there that shows even a small interest, you know, something like little billboards. Mm-hmm. Like if I wanted that published, it would need to be full color.
Right.
That's something that possibly I could do through, you know, a self-publishing thing. You know what I mean? To keep the cost down, make it electronic or something like that, or do a fancy edition. I don't know. That would be separate. So I could use some of those marketing strategies or set up, you know, something like that. But as it is, you know, filtering through this kind of, you know, rabble of stuff published, you know, go read that article on middle school inclusion. Go read. I mean, it's just such a mess of stuff, and that's just partially my own interests and who I am. But it doesn't make it easy to, like, say, here's, you know, I'm the guy who does this, because that's not really how it works for me. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if my response to those things is like just to maybe ignore it as much as possible. I don't know, and trying to keep writing and just going forward that way. I don't know.
Yeah. That seems to be really the best answer for anything, isn't it? Just keep writing.
That's
even if you're alone in a shack in the middle of Montana, just keep writing, otherwise you'll turn into the Unabomber.
That's right.
All right. I think that's a good place to leave it for today. Yeah. Is that the Unabomber? And we'll pick this up next month then, I guess.
Yeah, sounds good.